matter of 3 or 4 minutes, but I might have said so much that I had never said before, but I expect he got my thoughts and knew I was too surprised at the time to say all that was in my heart. About a week later I got the impression that Dada would like me to go to a medium so that he could speak to me, so I attended a circle held by the well-known trance medium, Mr. J.J. Van Gogh. Mr. Van Gogh did not know me, but soon after going into trance he described my father exactly as he was in his earth life, giving his name, the way he passed over, and many other details, which made me quite sure it was my father whom he described. Mr. Van Gogh then told me about my father's visit to me, and how pleased he was that I had seen him, and that he would keep in touch with me from over there. Other messages followed. It was a remarkably evidential and comforting sitting. Since then my father has given me proof after proof of his continued interest in me and in my life. In fact, as I was writing the preceding paragraph, just a few minutes ago, I became conscious that he was sitting on the couch in front of me, evidently very interested in what I was telling you about him. 54. Chapter 17, I face an unpleasant ordeal again. I hear so many people say, "Do the spirits ever tell you anything useful?" It is rather difficult to define everybody's idea of what the word useful means. Personally, I think they are being useful in the best and highest sense of all when they take so much trouble to come and give us evidence that they exist, and remember us. As my uncle and father did, because by doing so they are giving us the happiness of realizing that there is no death, and we can therefore look forward to another life where they will welcome us. Somewhere, someone, I am not sure who, wrote, "Who takes away death's sting deprives life of its bitterness. Yes, and adds exceedingly to its sweetness." The Psychic Faculties and Their Development, published by the LSA Publications Limited, 16 Queensbury Place, London, S.W. Middle. 7 Middle. But I think I know what inquirers of this type really want to know. It is, can, and do, their spirits ever tell anything that helps in a strictly material or earthly sense? Yes, I can truthfully say that from time to time I have had proof that they can help us when it is desirable that they should do so, but they always remind us that we must shoulder our own responsibilities, develop our willpower, wisdom, and discretion, as much as possible, as they are not allowed to interfere with our individual development by helping on any and every occasion the people who expect them to do so, and I fear that there are a great many, are often very disappointed. There are several different times in my life, in recent years, when I have indeed been materially helped by the guides and friends who have passed over in a way that deeply impressed me at the time and ever since. In the summer of 1925 I began to feel less strong and well than usual. I suffered from extreme weakness and fatigue. It had nothing to do with my psychic work, as it began just after I had had an unusually long holiday. I began to suffer with what appeared to be acute neuralgia in my face and head. It grew worse. The pain was dreadful. I developed a temperature and was very feverish, breaking out into baths of perspiration during the night. Never having had such symptoms before, I was nonplussed to account for them in any way, or to know what to do. I must tell you that I have a very dear friend, Miss Helen McGregor, whom many of you may know, not only on account of her fine psychic powers, but as co-author of one of the best books on psychical development that I have ever read. Perhaps only a few people know that Miss McGregor possesses healing power to an extraordinary degree. Her gift for diagnosis is well known, but her guides only allow her to use her actual healing power in exceptional cases and circumstances. She had several times healed me on previous occasions of a bad internal chill, and on one occasion after a motor accident, when I had some very nasty injuries indeed. So, as I grew alarmingly worse, and the pain was so acute I could not eat or sleep, but only pace up and down my bedroom till I was too exhausted to walk any longer, and then fall on the bed till the pain forced me to get up and pace the room again, my husband telegraphed to Miss McGregor, begging her to come and see me. For several days my face had been gradually swelling and discoloring. When Miss McGregor entered my bedroom, I must have looked a pretty sight. By then the left side of my face had swollen to the size of a football, and was green, red, purple, and most of the other colors of the rainbow. One eye was completely closed, and I could hardly open my mouth. She looked at me, and in spite of her habitual self-control, she gasped. I shall never forget her expression of astonishment and dismay. I could have laughed had I not been in such pain. She made me sit in a chair, though I doubted my ability to keep still for 2 minutes together. Then she began making passes over me, and to my intense astonishment their dreadful pain subsided, so that I could sit still in comparative comfort. For nearly half an hour she worked on me, scarcely touching me with her hands, but only doing their passes. The relief and relaxation of my tired nerves was so great at the cessation of the agony I had been enduring, that I could hardly realize it when Miss McGregor said to me, "Now, look at yourself in the glass," and on doing so I saw that the swelling had almost gone, and the discoloration had faded so that there were only a few faint purple streaks left. I was speechless with gratitude, it seemed like a miracle. Miss McGregor then said, "Gladys, I am impressed strongly that it is something inside your mouth that is causing the trouble. There are some old roots there, buried in the gums, and they are now septic, and are poisoning you badly. You must have them out, as quickly as possible." I was dismayed, as I remembered the awful experience I had after the extractions of a few years previously, how ill I had been and the setback it had been to my work. Of course I realized that only my teeth had been taken out on that occasion, and that their remainder had just broken off in the gums and were probably making trouble there, as my friend suggested. The thought of risking another such horrid experience as befell me after that last dental operation was terrifying. Also, I had important engagements to fulfill now, and I did not want to endanger my psychic work, on which so many people now depended. I told Miss McGregor all this, and she suggested that in a day or two, when I was rested, we should ask Fada to control me, and say whether she thought I should have my teeth extracted or not. Miss McGregor came every day and gave me further healing. By the end of the week, all traces of the poison had disappeared, and all pain had gone, too, so I was able to resume my sittings, but when we asked Fada to come and speak to us, and advise us about the proposed extractions, she would not do so, and I was strongly impressed that I had to choose for myself, instead of trying to put the choice and responsibility onto the people on the other side. I felt sure that if I chose to have the teeth taken out, Fada and the other spirit friends would help me, but they did not want me to lean on them for a decision in matters that affected my physical self. Quite suddenly, one evening when sitting quietly by myself, I felt that I must decide to see a good dental surgeon at once, and have the offending teeth removed. I mentally asked a doctor friend, who had recently passed over, if he would help me, and I also asked Miss McGregor's brother, who was a doctor killed in the war, if he would help. I had a very strong impression that, now I had decided, everything possible would be done from the other side to safeguard my health and work. The next morning I received a letter from Mrs. Kelway Bamber, the author of Claude's books, who is a sister of Ms. McGregor. In her letter she said she had heard from her sister about the possibility of my having the extractions, and that while she was paying a visit to a friend, she had been impressed to ask if this friend knew a really good surgeon dentist, and she said she knew a very excellent one indeed, and gave Mrs. Kelway Bamber both his professional and his home address. To Mrs. Kelway Bamber's surprise, his home was in my neighborhood. Directly I read her letter, I felt sure this was the right dentist, and that evening I asked my husband to call on him and tell him that I should like to see him professionally, and to be sure to apologize for calling at his home address. My husband went, and rather to his surprise the dentist said, "I'll call and see Mrs. Leonard in her own home tomorrow, Saturday evening." Now I had invited an old friend, Mrs. Nora Parsi, to spend the Saturday evening with us. She knew nothing about my teeth trouble, as I had not seen her for some time, and she was merely coming to dine with us and have a chat, so I had not wanted to bother her with details about my health. However, when she arrived I had to tell her that I was expecting somebody that evening and that I must leave her for a few minutes, and briefly explained the circumstances. She said, "I wish I had known you wanted a first-class dentist. I have only lately come across such a man, quite by accident, in a very unexpected way. I do wish you could have had him instead of this unknown man you've got hold of." I said, "What is your wonderful dentist's name?" And to my astonishment she mentioned the name of the man who was coming to see me that night. "Remember, Mrs. Parsi and I lived in entirely different places, several miles apart, and she had only known of their dentist's West End address. She had no idea that he neighborhood. We both thought this was a strange coincidence, to say the least of it. He arrived, and his personality immediately filled me with confidence. After examining my mouth, he said, "You have 19 teeth that must come out as soon as possible. Some of them are broken off in the gums and will be difficult to dig out, but don't fear, I shall get them out, but you will have to have chloroform and ether, so you must either go into a nursing home, or I must bring a doctor whom I know down here and perform the operation in your own room." I agreed to the latter suggestion, and we arranged to have it carried out on Sunday, November the 8th, at noon. 19 teeth out all at once seemed a tall order. Several friends warned me that it was too many, and it would be a terrible shock to the system, and so on, but Miss McGregor came down each day, and gave me a healing treatment so as to buck me up for the ordeal, and Mrs. Parsi most kindly volunteered to come and stay with me, and see me through the whole thing, as she had had a great deal of experience in surgical work during and after the war. I felt overwhelmed with gratitude to her, as I knew what an unpleasant business such an operation must be to watch, but the dentist had said I must have a trained nurse with me, and when I told him of Mrs. Parsi's generous offer, he was very pleased. He did not tell me who the doctor was that he proposed to bring, but we felt it was best to leave that matter entirely to him. On Sunday morning I awoke feeling quite happy and calm, had a bath, no food, of course, got back into bed, and watched Mrs. Parsi getting a flat couch ready near the window for me to lie on. While she was out of the room I glanced across towards the fireplace, and there, to my surprise and relief, I saw both the doctors who had passed over, and whom I had asked to help me, the one being Miss McGregor's brother, and the other my friend who had passed over only that last summer. They were sitting on chairs, one each side of the fireplace, quietly discussing something. In rather low voices, so I could not hear what they said. Then one of them looked across at me, and said to the other, "Oh, she'll be all right," and I knew they meant me. Their knowledge that they were there helped me very much. Even when I heard the ring at the bell which announced the arrival of the dentist and the doctor, I did not feel nervous in the least. Mrs. Parsi had come back into my room, and when they entered it, to her great astonishment, the doctor was a friend of hers. He was as surprised to see her there as she was to see him. Another coincidence, and a very strange one too, you must admit. I lay down on the couch, and the doctor proceeded to give me the anesthetic. I did as he told me, breathed it in gently, but all the breathing in didn't seem to take effect. He kept saying, "Can you still hear me speaking to you?" And I kept on answering, "Yes, I can. Unfortunately, I wish I couldn't," until I really began to think I was never going to go under. Then just as I felt like saying, "For goodness sake, give up trying this, it's no good, I can't become unconscious," I heard a man's loud voice issuing from my own lips, and knew that I was being controlled by some strong discarnate influence. Afterwards I heard that this was Dr. McGregor, who told them to give me some more of the anesthetic, as he knew I should require a great deal more than most people to put me under. I think it must have been a very peculiar and trying operation for the dentist and his friend, because during the operation they were being literally bullied into doing this or that, and at one period, when it were regaining consciousness before the extractions were finished, my spirit friends shouted, "Give her some more." The doctor looked inquiringly at Mrs. Parsi, who knew what was happening and that I was being controlled, and she felt impressed to say, "Doctor, do give her some more, please, at once." "Well," said the doctor, "she's already had sufficient for three people, but here goes." So that I had some more. In fact, I had all the spare stuff they had brought with them, as well as what they expected I might require. Directly he had finished the extractions, the dentist left the room with the doctor. He knew that he was leaving me in good hands. He could see how competent Mrs. Parsi was, but he told her I should probably sleep for some time. As soon as the two men left the room, Mrs. Parsi's husband, who was killed early in the war and who is often near her, controlled me, and spoke to his wife in a clear and evidential way for about 10 minutes. She was astounded. As she remarked afterwards, she had certainly not expected a small sitting to be given her during a dental operation. When Major Parsi stopped speaking, I immediately awoke, as fresh and all there as if I had just awakened from an ordinary night's refreshing sleep. I jumped off the couch and got into my own bed as if nothing had happened, and Mrs. Parsi told me of some of the things that had been said through me to the doctor and dentist, part of which I had been conscious of, though I had felt no pain whatever. We shrieked with laughter over some of the remarks made, as we knew that neither of them would know what on earth it all meant, except that I was a very peculiar patient. Mrs. Parsi told me that their operation, and the dentist's handling of it, struck her as astounding, because though their gums had grown right over some of the stumps, entirely concealing them, he had not lanced the gums, but seemed to find the teeth by instinct, gently and quietly drawing out each with apparently no effort whatever. Her opinion was that he was being guided by somebody who could see the hidden stumps, but my dentist friend, who prides himself on being a stout materialist, maintains that he was simply being a little more brilliant than usual. I don't argue with him. Both Mrs. Parsi and I have our own ideas on their subject, and at the back of his mind I believe he thinks as we do, but he won't admit it. A curious feature was that there was not the slightest trace of chloroform or ether in their room immediately after, though the whole of the rest of the house reeked with it, and as it was cold weather, my bedroom window had to be kept tightly closed, yet within a moment all trace of the smell had disappeared. Mrs. Parsi said she had never known such a thing happen in all her hospital experience. 59. Towards evening the poor gums began to rebel against the cutting they had had, and the pain grew worse and worse. Mrs. Parsi told me it was bound to be so, and that if one had only a couple of stumps extracted, one must expect pain afterwards, but after the removal of 19, one would certainly have to go through it. I did go through it, and to such an extent that I almost wished I had never had the teeth out, as it was as bad as the most violent toothache. Miss McGregor had promised to come about 8 o'clock that evening in order to give me a healing treatment, as she knew what I was likely to be feeling. She came, treated me, and within a quarter of an hour every scrap of pain had gone, and from that time on, I never had the slightest discomfort in any portion of my mouth. I think that was really extraordinary, because the dentist showed Mrs. Parsi the teeth as he extracted them, and there was an abscess on nearly every one. Ms. McGregor is certainly a marvelous channel for the healing power, as far as I am concerned. It may guide on the other side, and mine, are in close touch together, and such teamwork in spiritual things is always very satisfactory and successful. I am inclined to think that this is their explanation of Miss McGregor's remarkable healing effect on me. Chapter 18, I hear a strange word. Here is another instance of what might be called premeditated help and teamwork on the part of several spirit friends, combined with an attempt, and a very successful one, too, to give me some evidence about things that were quite unknown to me at the time. Though, consciously, I felt no specially bad effects that I could definitely trace back to the illness and dental operation I have just told you about, I found that for some time after I became easily run down, and a couple of years later I had a bad attack of influenza, from which I seemed quickly to recover, but I found that a septic condition was showing itself in the thumb of my right hand. It swelled and became so unsightly and unpleasant that, for hygienic reasons, I had to wrap it up. After trying everything that everybody recommended to me, it still became worse, and I called in a local doctor, a surgeon, who pointed out that I had a swelling coming under my arm, the right one, and that it was due to the infection from the thumb, which should be operated on. I did not like the idea of an operation, so he said I could leave it for a few days but not longer, and try some ointment, etc., that he had made up for me. In the meantime, I did as he told me, but after 2 or 3 days the condition was worse. My husband was very much impressed that I should still try other means and not have an operation. Now, I had met several times at a friend's house a West End doctor, who is an ultraviolet ray specialist. I knew very little about his treatment, but I wrote to him asking if it was possible that it might help my trouble, which I explained to him in detail, and told him that the surgeon said that an operation was the only cure. This doctor wrote back saying he felt sure he could help me, and told me to come to him at once. Directly I showed him my hand, he said, a couple of treatments with the ultraviolet rays will clear that trouble up entirely. Frankly, I did not believe him. I was so tired of trying first one thing, then another, but I took the treatment, which consisted of a few minutes exposure of my thumb to the ultraviolet rays given off by a mercury vapor lamp. On my way home I thought the flesh looked a better color than it had looked since their septic condition began. I could hardly believe it, it seemed too good to be true. I had a Second treatment 2 days later, and one would hardly have recognized the thumb. I had a couple more which entirely cleared up the trouble, and only wished I had thought of writing to the doctor when the symptoms first showed themselves, but in a very busy life, as mine is, one is inclined just to take whatever means that first come to hand. I forgot all about my thumb, only too glad to be able to, and went on with much better health for another year or two. One afternoon I had an appointment for a sitting, and, as is my custom on such occasions, I went to lie down in my bedroom, drawing their curtains half across the window. 61. As soon as I had lain myself down on the bed and closed my eyes, I don't always sleep at these times, but simply relax, I heard a voice on my left, quite close to me, a man's voice, say one word that sounded to me like Titanic or Titanic. The voice was so natural that I immediately said aloud, without moving or opening my eyes, "What did you say? Titanic? Are you someone who was drowned on the Titanic?" "No," replied the voice, much more distinctly and slowly, "I said Titanic. I am spelling it as it sounded to me at the time." "Oh," I said, "do explain, what does it mean?" "I don't know the word. Do explain," but I heard no more. I lay thinking it over, wondering what the strange word could possibly mean, and found myself drifting into a psychic condition. I saw, clairvoyantly, that there were several people around me. Their forms were not very clear, but I saw one more distinctly than the others, and recognized him as Sir Dash, a distinguished scientist, who had recently passed over, and whom I had known. He had been interested in my psychic work. I heard him say something about remembering my thumb, but it was very indistinct. I then became quite normal again, arose and went downstairs, trying hard to put two and two together. First, the new strange word, diatinic, then the people who seemed to be looking at me in rather a solicitous way, and the great scientist who only murmured, "Remember your thumb." It all seemed so disconnected. My husband's niece, Rita Watkins, was staying with us at the time, so as my sitter had just arrived, I said hurriedly, "Rita, have you ever heard the word diatinic, and do you know what it means?"
"Never heard it in my life," she replied.
"Neither have I," I said, and I left her looking rather bewildered, as the middle dot was no time to explain. During tea, after my sitting, I told Rita about my puzzling experience. She got a dictionary, and we went through all the D's and D's till we found the word diatinic, and the meaning given was actis, actinos, a ray, capable of transmitting the actinic or chemical rays of the sun. Of course, I immediately understood that this meant the ultraviolet ray treatment, and the reference about remembering my thumb fitted in, but I was more puzzled than ever, as my thumb had never been bad again, and I felt particularly well, so I put their whole thing out of my mind. A couple of days later, I developed a really bad attack of influenza, which I had most probably caught from a sitter who came to me about 3 days earlier, and who was suffering with flu when she visited me, though she did not know it at the time. I took care of myself, but on recovering from the influenza itself, I discovered to my dismay that the middle finger of my right hand was beginning to show symptoms of the same nature as my thumb had done 2 years previously. Then I understood at once the message about diatinic and what followed. I immediately arranged with my most kind and helpful doctor for some more treatment with the ultraviolet rays, feeling quite confident as to the outcome, but I was unable to understand 62. Why the very famous scientist should be interested in the matter,
when the word. Several people over there who would know both my doctor here and myself more intimately, and who would be more likely to give me such a message than this. Gentlemen.